Beloved Bhagwan, when Husain Shah became enlightened, he said to other monks, "The whole universe is a brilliant jewel of the Buddha mind." Dogen continued, "This brilliant jewel is originally nameless, but provisionally we gave it such a name. This jewel is eternally unchangeable. Really, our body and mind, grass and trees here and there, or mountains and rivers between heaven and earth, all this is nothing but a brilliant jewel. It is boundless from beginning to end. After all, the whole universe is one brilliant jewel, not two or three. The whole jewel is the Buddha's eye, truth itself, one phrase of truth, the light of enlightenment. At this time, it never hinders the whole one, and it is round and rolls about. The function of this brilliant jewel is so clear that the sentient beings are saved by present-day Avalokitesvara or Maitreya just by seeing their look or hearing their voice, and also the Buddhas, ancient and modern, expound the Dharma with their whole body. A sutra says that someone was lying drunk when his great friend sewed a jewel in his robe secretly. We must never fail to give this jewel to our intimate friend. We are never drunk without being given such a jewel. Such a brilliant jewel is identical with the whole universe. Therefore, a brilliant jewel is a brilliant jewel itself, whether it rolls or not. Our realization that such is a jewel is also a jewel itself, so audible and visible is it. Therefore, it is no use wondering if we are a brilliant jewel. Whether we doubt or discern it, it is only a small provisional viewpoint. To say more precisely, a brilliant jewel only pretends a small viewpoint. We cannot help setting a great value on this jewel, so brilliant is the color and light of it. Who could snatch it? Who could cast it away in a market, regarding it as a tile? We must not worry about whether we transmigrate in the six realms of existence on the law of causality. A brilliant jewel never sets aside the law of causality from beginning to end. This is the face of a brilliant jewel.
Manisha. There is only one experience, but there can be 1001 expressions. Still no expression expresses it. That's its beauty, that's its immense richness. That's its infinity, eternity. No word can catch hold of it. But a man who comes home, who finds it, is also compelled by its finding to share the joy, the song, the haiku, to say something about that which cannot be said. It is an absolute compulsion. You have to do something to make the whole world aware. What have you found? Because what you have found, everybody else can find, just they have forgotten the way. And it is so close, just as you close the eyes, one step more inwards, and you have arrived. All these Zen anecdotes and dialogues, again and again, say the same thing. But they say it very beautifully, from different standpoints, from different altitudes. They point the same moon, hoping that perhaps if last night you did not see it, today it may be possible from some another aspect. The master is nothing but a great hope for the disciple, waiting simply for you to understand a simple thing which he cannot deliver to you as a matter, because it is immaterial. But its pricelessness is such that he cannot ignore either not to do something in order to provoke you and challenge you to search inwards. All these anecdotes are nothing but provocations challenges. Out of deep love and compassion has arisen these statements, not out of mind. This has to be remembered about every anecdote, every dialogue, every small Zen haiku, that the master is trying in some way the impossible. And the impossible happens once in a while. So it cannot be denied, and it cannot be said that the whole thing is futile, no need to bother about others. Enlightenment brings with itself the tremendous love for all those who are in darkness, just because they are standing with closed eyes and they think they are blind. Somebody has to nag them to open their eyes. And perhaps their eyes has been closed for so many lives. They have forgotten completely that they have eyes. So much dust has gathered. The whole work of the master is to remove the dust. And give you a challenging call so that your innermost being wakes up. And once it is awakened, you will see that all the efforts of the masters were faulty. Just his compassion was immense. His efforts were faulty because there is no direct way to express the inexpressible. But he still tried. Knowing it perfectly well that he is on an impossible journey. But when somebody awakes, he can see all the faults of the master, but they don't matter. Only thing that matters is a deep gratitude to this incredible man who went on saying again and again, day after day, the same thing, hitting as hard as possible. Perfectly aware that it is very rare that a man recognizes his Buddhahood. But because it is only a recognition, the possibility is that everybody one day will recognize. Why not today? There is no need to postpone it. But in the past, in a way it was easier because there were so many Buddhas around. It was conceivable that you can also be a Buddha. Unfortunately, that is not the case today for the contemporary man. The word Buddha is just a word. It is very rare that you will come across a Buddha in your whole life. And even if you come across, you will not be able to recognize because you have forgotten completely the language. You have learned the ways of matter so much and so deeply that they are standing as a block for your spiritual flight to the moon, to the immense sky that is your right. Whatever the masters say, always remember, you are not to analyze the words. These are not treatises for PhDs and D-Lits. And these are not words spoken to the spectators. Just a single spectator in this Buddha field, and I can recognize immediately a whole of energy. The day you had a poet's gathering, I felt so much wounded because I could see that you rise to your heights every day, but that day you could not rise. Just those few poets were dragging the whole energy of the field. They were like drainage. I was trying my heart, but it was impossible. But those people will never understand that they have missed a tremendous experience because they remained a spectator. They looked here, they looked there, they could not believe, they whispered with each other that what is happening. They could not take a jump and participate. And because of those few people, the whole energy field was torn, broken. I told Neelam that this should never happen again. I don't want a single spectator here in this field. While I'm speaking, you have to be a participant. Otherwise, this is not the place for you. You can have your poets' gathering and other social entertainments after I have left, but don't allow those people . It is not their fault, just they don't know what is happening here. They are curious, and their curiosity does not allow them to participate. And because they are not participating, the chain of energy that joins you all together into one whole consciousness is broken. Every place, the height that is becoming more and more, you could not reach that day. Although those poets tried to pretend as if they are participating, but it was only as if. They did the gibberish, but I could see that it is just a very shallow thing for them. They are doing it because everybody else is doing, and not to do it will look a little awkward. They sat in silence, but there was no silence. They were preparing for their poetries, thinking about what they are going to recite. When I said to relax, they certainly relaxed as everybody else, but there is a qualitative difference. When you relax, you know the purpose, the meaning, the significance. They were relaxing just because everybody else is relaxing. But even relax, they will opening their eyes and looking around. What kind of relaxation? The whole effort is to forget the whole world. That's why I say even leave the body, leave the mind, so that you can discriminate clearly what is consciousness. And this consciousness is the Buddha. While you are in that consciousness, you are at the highest peak of life. Just the very freedom on those heights makes one dance, sing, just like birds, blossom like flowers, with no effort. It happens spontaneously. That's why after the meditation I want you always to sit for a few minutes to gather the experience, the path, the heights, the fragrance of those depths, so that you can go on slowly, remaining a Buddha all the year round. And remember, once a Buddha, you are always a Buddha. Nobody has fallen from that point. It is just against nature. Dogen said, when Suansa became enlightened, he said to other monks, the whole universe is a brilliant jewel of the Buddha mind. What he is saying and is being said by every Buddha, the moment one becomes enlightened, he could not see anything that is not enlightened. He sees trees standing silently in enlightenment, and the moon brilliant in enlightenment. Your enlightenment makes you a universal consciousness. You are no more separate. It is not that you have become enlightened. The universe for you has become enlightened. And now naturally, with an enlightened universe, you cannot misbehave. You can be only grateful to all that exists. Even the darkest nights don't create a complaint in you, but just a deep peace and a waiting, because soon there will be morning. Darker the night, closer the sun. But night itself is a joy. The day has its own joy. Every moment has its own flavor. For the enlightened person, remember, it is not that he is enlightened, On the contrary, remember, for him the whole existence has become enlightened. All light and all consciousness, all truth and all beauty. Swansa's statement after his enlightenment, the whole universe is a brilliant jewel of the Buddha mind. Nothing is other than Buddha. Dzogchen continued, this brilliant jewel is originally nameless, but provisionally we gave it such a name. Anything that we say about the ultimate experience is only provisionally, arbitrary. So don't argue upon words and don't depend on words. No word is absolutely accurate. Language simply falls fall below those heights, and those depths are beyond. It cannot reflect them. Only the great compassion of the Master and his brilliance express something of the inexpressible, but that is so subtle that unless you are silent, utterly silent, you will not be able to catch hold of it. This jewel is eternally unchangeable. Really, our body and mind, grass and trees, here and there, our mountains and rivers, between heaven and earth, all this is nothing but a brilliant jewel. Everything is nothing but an expression of universal spirit. That universal spirit we call the Buddha. It is only a provisional name. It is boundless from beginning to end. After all, the whole universe is one brilliant jewel, not two or three. The whole jewel is the Buddha's eye, truth itself. One phrase of truth, the light of enlightenment. The light that radiates from the Buddha is only one phase. The experience is multidimensional. It has beauty in it. It has music in it. It has truth in it. It has everything that is valuable, imperishable, light has been chosen provisionally to express it. It is only one of the aspects. When we call the enlightened one, it is just
taking out one part, one aspect of the whole experience to represent it. At this time, it never hinders the whole one, and it rounds and rolls about. The function of this brilliant jewel is so clear that the sentient beings are saved by present-day Avalokiteshvara or Maitreya, just as seeing their look or hearing their voice, and also the Buddhas, ancient and modern, expound dharma with their body. Gautam Buddha himself has said, this very body, the Buddha, and this very earth, the lotus paradise. Once you are enlightened, your vision is so clear that everything in that clarity shows its spirit, its life, its source, and that source is one. It is not two, it is not three. A sutra says that someone was lying drunk when his great friend sewed a jewel in his robe secretly. We must never fail to give this jewel to our intimate friend. He is just telling that this experience is impossible even to give to the intimate friend. You can provoke it, but you cannot give. It is not something in your hands. It is lying down in your intimate friend's very heart. You can make devices just as tickling brings laughter, although there is no reasonable connection. Why tickling should bring laughter? I have known one person who does not need to be tickled. Just from far away, you make the gesture and that was enough. Here is also one person. Everybody knows him. She is sitting so Buddha-like that just if I do this right now, there is Ananda. That is Ananda. I said, school. This is the only way Buddhahood arises. The master has to tickle. Now, do you see the effect? I have not even tickled Avirbhava, neither I have tickled Ananda. And you are all laughing. This tickling is called in the sutras the great transmission. I have not even touched. The master can only create a device. The device has no logical connection. Now, do you see why you are laughing? Of course, Avirbhava at least is tickled from far away. Remote control. But why you are laughing? I have a remote control. Just sit like a Buddha. Yeah. Close your eyes. Look inside. A Zen poet has written, see his face but once, remember his name 1,000 years. He is talking about his master. Once you have seen the face of the master, you cannot forget for thousands of years, because in that small moment you have seen yourself. A master is at the most a mirror. He can show you your face if you come closer. And all disciplehood is nothing but coming closer and closer and closer, so that you can look into the eyes of your master, into his gestures, your own Buddhahood. See his face but once. Remember his name 1,000 years. Another Zen poet, one call invites 100 comrades. One smile beacons 10,000 admirers. You have just seen. Do you want to see it again? Controls. One is Abir Baba, another is Ananda. Wherever they are in the universe, just tickling, they will laugh. And with them, others will laugh for no reason at all. I want you to understand, enlightenment is so light, so loving, so peaceful, just like a laughter. The theologians have made it so heavy, so burdensome, that people ignore it. Enlightenment should also be entertainment at the same time. It reminds me about Jai Krishnamurti's laugh last sentence before he died, just few months before. He was a very serious person, and that was his only fault. He was enlightened, but he took enlightenment as a serious matter. He saw that he is enlightened and nobody is enlightened. And he is trying hard to make people enlightened, obviously. And for 70 years, he died at the age of 90. For 70 years from the age 20, he has been working on people. And not a single person has become enlightened. Obviously, you can understand his deep failure and his sadness becoming more and more serious, almost a sickness. And the reason is clear by his last statement, that people don't take enlightenment seriously. They think it is entertainment. And that is where I differ. Enlightenment cannot be anything else than entertainment. Universal entertainment. A laughter that knows no bounds, no limits. You laugh and the trees laugh and the cuckoos laugh and the clouds laugh and the stars laugh and the laughter goes on spreading because everybody is triggering everybody else. You need not actually trigger. Just your laughter will be enough somebody else to start laughing. I love J. Krishnamurti and I love his hard effort of 70 years continuously, but I am absolutely against his attitude. He was making it a serious affair. That was the fault of all the old prophets. That's why you will not find a statue of Mahavira laughing. What a miserable world. You don't allow even Mahavira to laugh. You will not find a statue of Gautam Buddha laughing. People, even if Gautam Buddha laughed, will not believe their eyes or ears that what is happening. Such a serious man. But you don't understand that when the mind is gone, you are just like a small child. Laughter will arise. Without any effort on your part. At least I am a break away from the whole past and I want in the future my people to be laughing Buddhas. Serious ones we have seen enough, they have not been able to transform humanity. Let us try another direction of non-seriousness. One call invites 100 comrades. One Buddha, just his presence, magnetically pulls 1,000 Buddhas, 10,000 Buddhas. It is a question how great your enlightenment is, how great your compassion and love is, and how non-seriously you have taken it. Nobody likes a serious person. Have you ever thought about it? That all the saints are serious. It is perfectly good to go and touch their feet and be finished. Nobody wants their company. Just think, these people will be going to heaven. Remember it. The heaven is overcrowded with saints. If you want the right kind of people, the other place. There you will find poets, and you will find painters, and you will find dancers and musicians. I am going particularly to the other place. So remember, whoever is with me, will have a great journey and a meeting of great people, because no saint has been of any value. No creativity, no poetry, no painting, all these people who were creators, who have made this world a little beautiful, a little more livable, are gathered in the other place. Friedrich Nietzsche said, God is dead, but he did not tell why he is dead. He has to be dead, surrounded by all these idiots, eternally stinking, because most of them don't take bath, don't wash their mouth, laughter is absolutely unknown in the paradise. Poor God could not survive. So I warn you, beware if by chance you reach to the gates of heaven, refuse. Don't enter in. Ask for the way to the other place. I will be waiting there for you. Ask for me, and that will be. Cry after cry, after cry of joy, not minding the hair turning white. This Zen poet is saying, even crying is so beautiful, so lightening, so unburdening, that cry after cry, after cry of joy, not minding the hair turning white. Don't be worried about time, space, age. Just learn to laugh and cry totally. Because these are the simplest ways to reach your innermost being. Manisha has asked, beloved Bhagwan, our most brilliant and precious jewel, whenever I have asked about your beauty, you have insisted that it is the eyes of love that project beauty on you. But you do not have the experience of sitting before you, following as we do, your each movement, tracing every beloved curve and line and valley in your face. I know of no one else, however much I love them, that I could gaze on for years, never feeling bored, never feeling I have fathomed their beauty. Manisha, in that case, I accept I am unfortunate. You are blessed to have a master who is not a burden on you. You are blessed to have a master who is not a masochist, a sadist, I was not so blessed. I had never come across a single man whom I could have called my master. I have to work my way alone. On my own. Going this way and that, falling and getting up again, nobody to guide, nobody to give any instruction, nobody even to indicate a finger to the moon. But it seems just by chance I happened to stumble upon the right place. I am a master who had no master. So I cannot see and cannot say what you see in my eyes, in my face. But whatever you are seeing is really a pure reflection of your love and your trust. Because this body will wither away. But I have another body of light. Before this body withers away, you have to become acquainted with my light body, with my inner center. And your center and my inner center are not two. In that area there is always one, neither two nor three. Now, before we enter into our daily meditation, just to drop all burden all the worries of the world have few good laughs, because I have not found anything better to create a right space to enter into yourself. Because your mind cannot understand laughter. Laughter is very illogical. A logical person cannot laugh. A logical person is confined to a very small area. I have not heard anything about Kant that he ever laughed. He could not. He was too serious a person. Just now I was talking to you about J. Krishnamurti. He used to come to India at least once or twice a year, and he has only three places: Varanasi, New Delhi, and Bombay. I have instructed all my sannyasins that wherever he is, either in India or outside India, just sit in the front line wherever he is speaking, and don't forget the orange and the mala. And that was enough. Then he will not speak on any other subject. That was enough to make him so angry that I have been telling my whole life, and my people loved it. They enjoyed it. Even few people who were not sannyasins used to go in orange, borrowing a mala from a friend. Just a single sannyasin was enough. Then he will forget everything what he was going to speak. Then he has just to condemn me, condemn sannyas, condemn everything, not understanding a simple thing, that you are being easily distracted. What does it matter? Somebody is wearing orange and having a mala. It is none of your business. But he was a serious man. He will hit his own head. He will become so angry, particularly in Bombay, because I was in Bombay. So hundreds of sannyasins will be sitting in front. And he will hit his head. I am so lazy that I cannot even hit my own head, neither anybody else. I am keeping for that purpose Zen Master Sekito stone heads. Where is your staff? Yeah, that's good. Because any moment it may be needed. and I have chosen a German Zen master. Because Japanese Zen masters will hit, but their hit will be just like a peacock feather. A real hit only German knows. And just see at his stone head. Have you saved your hairs or not? Save them completely. Yeah, let it go. Proper Sagar has arrived. Many of you may not know him. He is a very ancient sannyasi. But most of the old sannyasins will remember Proper Sagar. He's so proper in everything. Proper Sagar goes to visit Dr. Azima. He hangs up his umbrella and his hat. Then he takes off his jacket, his shirt and tie, and his trousers, folding them up very neatly and putting them on the chair. Then he takes off his shoes and puts them straight under the chair. Then he takes off his underwear, folds them nicely and puts them also on the chair, standing stiffly in front of Azima. Sagar calmly says, "As you can see, doctor, my left testicle hangs lower than my right one." He smiles, Azima, "But that is perfectly normal. You have nothing to worry about." "I'm not worrying," replies Proper Sagar. "But don't you think it is a bit untidy?" Quote, "The puller is on pilgrimage in Calcutta, where he makes an official visit to Mother Teresa's orphanage. Mother Teresa is showing him around, and the pollock is bending and kissing everything inside. Suddenly, as he bends over to kiss Mother Teresa's pride and joy, the new church organ, the Pope requires in terror. There is stretched out across the top of the organ is a big black condom, purple with rage. Pope the Pollock demands an explanation from Mother Teresa. "Well," says Mother Teresa, "one of my orphans found it in a package on the street. And when I read the label, it said, 'Place an organ and feel secure.'" Harold, Billy and Gabby, three tired and hungry cowboys, are sitting around a campfire about to eat dinner. Jose, the cook, a grimy, stumble-faced, huge Mexican guy, throws down the pot and holds up his gun. The first one of you jerks who makes a fuss about your supper gets trouble from me, says Jose. There is careful silence as the purple and green slop is served up and the eating begins. God, shrieks Harold, gagging and turning blue, this stuff tastes like shit. Then immediately eyeing the big Mexican Harold, adds enthusiastically, but good shit, real good. Dr. Feelgood is visiting the insane asylum to see the latest condition of some of his patients. He is led into the first room, opens the door, and meets Charlie Rose Cream. At that moment, Mr. Rose Kranz is swinging an imaginary golf club in the air. Well, Charlie, says Feelgood, when do you think you will be getting out? No problem, replies Charlie, swinging away, just as soon as I hit a hole in one. Feelgood shakes his head and goes on to the next room. There he finds Chester Cheese swinging an imaginary baseball bat. Hello, Chester, says Feelgood. And do you think you will be getting out? I soon, replies Chester, just as soon as I hit this home run. Feelgood shakes his head again and is led to the next room. He walks in and finds Donald Dickenstein rubbing a bag of peanuts up against his open zipper. Hello, Harold, says Feelgood. And when do you think you will be getting out? Out? Are you kidding? Says Donald excitedly. I'm fucking nuts.